March 25th is a key day on the calendar. No, not because it's now exactly 9 months until Christmas. It is American Diabetes Association Alert Day, a chance for people to pause and consider whether they are at risk for developing diabetes. It's more than a pause. It's a test to assess your risks. And it's not the kind of test that involves needles. Dr. Andrew Ahman is with the Harold Schnitzer Diabetes Health Center at Oregon Health Sciences University in Portland and our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Dr. Ahman, thanks for joining us.
Good morning. My pleasure.
So which are we talking about, a particular type of diabetes? There are two, correct?
Yeah, there's excuse me, this morning I have a little bit of a residual cold, but yeah, there's two types of diabetes, type 1 and type 2, and both of them are increasing somewhat. The real issue, and the one that lends itself most to prevention and early identification of the risk, is type 2 diabetes, which is the dominant one. Probably accounts for about close to 95% of all the diabetes in the United States.
And what are the major differences between type 1 and type 2? Is type 2 more severe? Is that the proper term?
I don't think you should think of either one as more severe. So type 1 used to be called juvenile diabetes, and that is what it really refers to, is that when kids have gotten diabetes, at least in the past, it's almost always been a fairly rapid onset process. They become very ill. It's very clear from the beginning that they will need insulin. And the problem is that it's an autoimmune disease that destroys the cells in the pancreas that make insulin. Type 2, rather than destroying all the cells that make insulin, seems to be more of a combination of our bodies just not responding to insulin as well, so we have to make more insulin. And at the same time, the beta cell that produces the insulin isn't able to handle the extra burden. So at least over time, we lose our ability to produce insulin to a significant degree. So there's a little difference. Unfortunately, type 2, which is the dominant form, is now finding its way into affect even youth.
So what is the growth trend then in type 2 diabetes? Is it really on a massive upswing?
Yeah, there's a dramatic increase. If you look over the last about two decades or so, and it doesn't seem to be stemming significantly at this point. The total number of people in the United States at this point, or if we, let's say we just look at the age over 20, that's about 11.3% of our population have diabetes. It is a disease that historically has been much more affected by age. So if you look at people over age 65, you find that about that almost 26% or 27% of those individuals over 65 get diabetes. But if you know, there have been proposals, the rate of increase is at least 7% or more per year in the United States. And if you look at projections, if we don't change the trend, we would actually have about a third of our population with diabetes in the year 2050. Or a different way of looking at that is, for babies born in the year 2000, one out of three have the likelihood that they'll develop diabetes in their lifetime.
And what do we attribute the upswing then? I mean, we're talking one in three by 2050 potentially. Now, granted, these figures can be arrested and turned around, we hope. But what are the things that are causing the upswing?
Yeah, it's very complicated. The simple answer, I suppose, is that you know, we've changed our lifestyle so much. So we aren't as active as we once were. We don't eat the kind of foods that we once did. We tend to all be overweight, or as a population at least, we have a high percentage that are over ideal body weight. And those are factors that lend themselves to this insulin resistance. Now, there's quite the there's significant differences according to ethnic or genetic background. And so it's likely that there are genetic predispositions to get diabetes. Part of this may have actually been an evolutionary thing where we became designed to be very efficient. And in the days when we had to hunt and gather, and people were thin and had to really work to get their food, and were very active at doing that and so forth, and it was a way to preserve energy and preserve our body strength and muscle and so forth. But then as we get into a society where food is readily available and where we don't have to walk, we don't exercise as much, that genetic, evolutionary genetics that helped protect us in many from hundreds of years ago suddenly are at a big disadvantage for us. And so what we think has happened is that our lifestyle changes play on a genetic background. And one example I frequently give is that in mainland China, where they actually had one of the lowest rates of diabetes a decade or two ago, they actually have one of the highest increases in diabetes. So they were probably a genetically predisposed population that, because of their lifestyle, was protected from diabetes. And as they got sort of westernization of their diet and their activity patterns, they've actually increased at the rate of about 30 to 40% per year.
So here again, it's the body's efficiency. I remember reading years ago a New Yorker piece about the Pima Indians in particular, where they lived in a desert environment for centuries, and so their bodies had to store up fat for a long time. Once they were faced with modern diet, though, I mean, I think half the tribe is now diabetic.
Right. Yeah, that is the actual population with the highest rate of diabetes, where about 50% are likely to get diabetes. And there again, yeah, it's exactly one of the best examples of a genetic background that, with changes in their environment, ended up being sort of scourged by this disease.
Dr. Andrew Ammons, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He's at Oregon Health Sciences University at the Harold Schnitzer Diabetes Health Center. We are talking about American Diabetes Association Alert Day today, March 25th. You can join us and ask more questions about what we do on Diabetes Alert Day at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. So we're talking about a risk assessment, basically, here, yes?
Right. So we know that there's about 79 million people in the United States who have prediabetes, which is sort of a determination made by the Center for Disease Control around people who are progressing toward, have a higher likelihood of getting diabetes because their blood sugars, for instance, are not in a range that we can call diabetes, but we know are in a range that are moving away from normality, and therefore they have a higher risk of getting diabetes. We know that general concept of a transition point of people at risk, and that at a point when they can do something to prevent diabetes, is critical to our changing this national trend. And therefore, this is the time when the American Diabetes Association really wants to alert people that you can go to the website, for instance, www.diabetes.org/risk-test, and that can be found on Facebook as well. And you can actually take a test that just takes a few seconds that looks at some of the major risk factors and then tells you actually what your risk is. And then the intention is that you would take that seriously and try to look for help to prevent diabetes if you're in a high-risk category.
Let us take a call here. We have Peter in Ashland on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Dr. Andrew Ammon. It is American Diabetes Association Alert Day.
First of all, could you repeat that website that you just said again?
So it's www.diabetes.org and then /risk-test.
Risk test.
All one word.
And I wonder if you could comment for a type 1 diabetic on where the best, your suggestions for the best places to search for information pertaining to any kind of like stem cell, anything about either sort of stem cell for the pancreas or talk about where the technology is these days.
All right, so therapies and where things are going. All right, thanks for that, Peter.
Right.
Appreciate it.
Yeah, so type 1 diabetes being the one where you basically don't make any insulin after a relatively short period of time in the disease, and you have to rely 100% on injected insulin, is a little different animal, and there is no other therapy other than insulin at this point. Now, the hope would be that we would come up with one of the things that people are working on, an artificial pancreas, and here even at OHSU we're working on an artificial pancreas, which would basically be a computerized pancreas sensing glucose and then delivering insulin through a computer connection. That would be miniaturized. But then the biological solution would be to be able to take the cells that were originally producing insulin in the body, because they both sense the glucose and produce the insulin, and that you'd be able to infuse those and get basically an islet cell transplant, it's called. There was some success with this a few years ago. It turned out to not be as good as they thought, and so many centers are now kind of were pushed back for a while, and now they're starting to increase their interest. There's many places where you could look for this. You could look for it on that same general website, diabetes.org, and there's a lot of information about type 1 as well as type 2. You could look at, there's a group called type 1 or T1D, and they have a website called MyGlu, M-Y-G-L-U, and I think that's .org as well. And that's a group that's all about patients with type 1, and they have lots of information on that website for people about what treatments there are, but also a lot of support from other people with diabetes. And then finally, the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation would also be a place that has a lot of that information.
So Dr. Andreoni is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange from Oregon Health Sciences University. We're talking about American Diabetes Association Alert Day today. Join us on the exchange if you'd like at 800-838-3760 or 541-552-6782 or by email jx@jeffnet.org. If you do then notice on this risk assessment, and you mentioned 79 million Americans, which is not quite a quarter of the population, looking pre-diabetic, so there are going to be some people who turn up these risk factors on this risk assessment they take on this day. What do they do then?
You should really seek help next from a primary care physician or provider, because you need to get your blood glucose tested to see if you have a fasting glucose that's between 100 and 125, which puts you in this pre-diabetes category. Or they can do another test called the hemoglobin A1C. And if that's in a range of 5.7 to 6.4, you have this pre-diabetes range. And then if you're over those ranges, so a fasting glucose over 125 or a hemoglobin A1C over 6.4, meaning starting at 6.5, you then actually have a diagnosis of diabetes. But you kind of have to go to that next step of checking. And then you can also be provided with the options, if you fall into that pre-diabetes category in particular, about what you can do to prevent yourself from progressing. Now, for a lot of younger people who might be in their 30s and so forth, if this risk test, just by association of their family history, their weight, a number of other factors, would indicate they're at high risk, those same principles about how you can prevent diabetes pertain even if you don't yet fall into the pre-diabetes range.
So if you're looking at these risk factors and willing to make the behavioral changes to, I mean, it does not necessarily follow that you are pre-diabetic and going to end up diabetic. It's not a sentence, right?
Right. Either if you find that you're in a risk category, it certainly doesn't mean that you're going to get diabetes. It just means you're in that segment of the population where we know more cases of diabetes come from. If you're in the pre-diabetes, if you go and have your blood sugar checked, for instance, you still fall into the pre-diabetes range of glucoses, of blood sugars, even then you don't really have an absolute risk that you're going to get diabetes. You just have a significantly increased risk. Fortunately, the things that are recommended are generally good health things, and so what you really find is, in many respects, diabetes is sort of a gateway disease anyway. And when people get type 2 diabetes, they have a much higher risk of heart disease, vascular disease. Turns out they even have a higher risk of cancer. And the things that change this dynamic, the lifestyle changes that you do to prevent diabetes, are likely to have a positive impact on heart disease and cancer as well. So there are changes we all can make, and if knowing that you have a risk of one disease heightens your concern and drives you to improve your health, that's really worthwhile, even if you're not going to be even if we can't tell you that you're definitely going to get diabetes.
How sensitive or responsive are our bodies to the changes we make in lifestyle? I mean, do we have to make tremendous changes if we find ourselves in the diabetes risk category, or is it really sort of incremental steps?
The information that we give out really relates to a study that was done through the National Institutes of Health a little more than a decade ago called the Diabetes Prevention Program. And in that program, what they did was they tried to get people to lose about 7% of their weight. Not all of them did. And they tried to get them to exercise for 30 minutes 5 days a week, and their primary method of exercise was really walking. So 30 minutes, 5 days a week walking. And that reduced the progression to diabetes by 60%. So it has a pretty profound effect, and we can show in the laboratory and research that that kind of activity can really improve insulin sensitivity, for instance, and improve some of the cholesterol levels and a number of other factors that should help protect from heart disease as well.
And what sorts of dietary changes would have the most impact for people in this category?
Yeah, we can spend a lot of time talking about low-carbohydrate diets or paleo diets or lots of different diets that are out there. I frequently say that the main message, I have this little slide I make for lectures where I say the main message to my book is you can make a lot of money off of a diet, out of a diet book, because there's so many out there, and obviously if there was a good diet that was absolute, we wouldn't have to have hundreds of diet books. The bottom line is you want a balanced diet, you want one that is, you want to reduce calories, and you do want to some degree reduce free sugars, try to reduce somewhat the glycemic index of your food. You want to eat more monounsaturated fats. You want to have more whole grains. You certainly want to limit your saturated fat significantly.
All right, and if anybody's wondering about how difficult this task is, I took it in the last minute. It took actually about 40 seconds by my count, and got the score already. Score of 4, 10 is the highest risk. So I'm pleased to report that I think I'm okay for now, but it's definitely worth the time. And I want to thank our guest for joining us. Dr. Andrew Ammann is with the Harold Schnitzer Diabetes Health Center at Oregon Health Sciences University. Thank you so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Yeah, my pleasure. Have a good day.
You bet. The test again at diabetes.org/risk test. Thanks for listening to this hour of the Jefferson Exchange. More coming up.